Okay.
You got to improve.
All right. I have no motivation, though. I mean, all you need is 16 decimal spots to do computer programming. So, okay, we good to go? Okay. Well, my wife warned me that the attendance could be really light today because everybody's going to be worshiping somewhere else. So, people gathering together around their TV set and preparing food and all that. So, we actually got some people coming over. We got to feed, so I can understand all that. But thank you for all your faithful ones who did come on this particular Sunday. Appreciate that. And AMP, what's interesting is that all of us are going to be giving 30-minute talks, and which is okay for the philosophers, but us scientists, we're all said we want new material. Okay, new material, complex, technical, 30 minutes, I don't know, but we're giving it a go. And we're going to really try to keep it simple, so I'll be presenting a lot less content than I normally do. Why you see this figure up here, and we will get to our class lesson.
You got to say that's not to scale also.
Well,
it bothers me.
It actually is approximately to scale. I'm going to tell you the context. Okay, all right. As a couple of days ago, I put up on my Facebook page, you know, what's going on with the Earth in Genesis 1-2. And what surprised me, in a period of 24 hours, over 120 comments. People asking questions, just wanting to know what's going on. And again, a conversation I have with my wife, she says, you need to realize that the reasons to believe interpretation that Genesis 1-2 is establishing the frame of reference may have been traditional during the Reformation era, but not today. The vast majority of pastors and seminary professors teach something quite different. So he says, that's why you got such a big reaction when you put it up on your Facebook page. And what I realized, all I did is I put up this one diagram saying this is what the earth was like before the Spirit of God began to work on the face of the earth. And one of the questions I got is, well, wait a minute. Genesis 1-2 doesn't say that there is water covering the whole face of the earth. It simply implies it. And, you know, they got a point. But it's like, maybe you need to read beyond Genesis 1-2 and see what the rest of it says. But, yeah, if you look at Genesis 1-2, it says, the earth was formless and empty, or void. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. So it clearly is making the point that there's liquid water in the surface of the earth. And I would say it implies that it's over the whole surface, but it doesn't explicitly say it's over the whole surface. But if you go down to verse 6, let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water. So God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse from the water above it. And it was so, and God called the expanse sky. Well, there you get a stronger implication that there's water everywhere. Then you move on into creation day 3. Let the water under the sky be gathered to one place and let dry ground appear. Now you've got an explicit statement. It's the first appearance of dry ground. And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then you can cross-reference this with Job 38. Verses 8 to 10, and Psalm 104, verses 6 through 9, which basically talks about creation day 3, and where it says that the water was indeed covering the whole of the earth, but that God separated and created these land masses. And now there were barriers, permanent barriers, between the seas and the land. And then verse 9 says, never again will water cover the whole face of the earth. Well, that implies that water did at one time cover the whole face of the earth. And so this, again, is a principle. Yeah, if you pick out one verse, and that's one of the restrictions I'm finding with social media. If you're on Twitter, you've only got 140 characters to make your point. So you have to drop some things out and hope people, you know, fill in the pieces. And even with Facebook, I mean, they really don't like you posting more than a couple of short paragraphs. And so again, you got to leave a lot out. And it's amazing how many times I was responding to questions saying, you know, I got a whole book on this. If you really want the details, get Navigating Genesis. It'll lay it out for you and tell you exactly where all this stuff comes. But it's also been a great opportunity for me to point out to people, if you want answers to these questions, you need to read the entire context. You know, read all of Genesis 1, not just one verse. And then read the passages that parallel Genesis 1. What was a shock to me is how many people, at least those visiting my Facebook page, weren't even aware that there were parallel creation texts. So I've been pointing out to them, yes, there are at least three. In fact, I'll ask you that question. Which three Bible texts outside of Genesis 1 take you through the content of the six creation days?
Psalm 104.
Okay, Psalm 104 is one of them. Psalm 104 does it in a lot of detail. Yes?
Job
37, 38, and 39. That's the most detailed. Genesis 1 is actually quite brief. If you really want the scientific details, what the text is saying, the most extensive is Job 37, 38, and 39. And it's interesting how often atheists will complain to me about Genesis 1 and said, this can't be the inspired word of God. Look at all the important stuff it leaves out. I says, yeah, but you understand that the content of the book of Job predates the content of Genesis. I got challenged on that too. What's your evidence that it predates it? Because they say there's plenty of scholarship saying Genesis was the first written text in the Bible. I says, yeah, you got a point. Job probably took written form a little bit later than Genesis. But if you read the book of Job, notice that the patriarchs are doing the sacrifices, the spiritual sacrifices, not the priests. That tells you it predates the priesthood. So this would make it pre-Mosaic. The other thing you notice in the book of Job, you don't have references to nations. You have references to city-states, but not to nations. So it's again to suggest this predates the time of the forming of nations. The other thing you get from the book of Job is it talks about a pastoral lifestyle that was predominant in the days before, well, basically the time of Abraham, because Job was referred to as a wealthy individual. But the level of his wealth is something that would be typical of a really wealthy person in the Abrahamic era, as opposed to the Mosaic era, where you now have kings that are ruling over empires. So those are just a few of the clues. There's other clues, and you can read about it in Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job over there. Clues that tell you the content of the book of Job predates the content of Genesis by about 500 or 600 years, at least 400 years. Now, here's another point you're going to notice when you look at the book of Job, especially if you look at it in the original Hebrew. Notice the entire book of Job is poetry except for the first chapter and a little bit of the last chapter. And a lot of Bible scholars think those two chapters were inspired by God after the book, the content of Job, was put forward. I'll answer your question, but let me point this point. When you actually look at it in the original Hebrew, the poetry in those 42 chapters, minus the few bits of prose you see in Job 1 and Job 42, it's written in such a way as to be easily memorized word for word. And again, living in the 21st century, we forget how peoples without a written language preserve their stories through memorization and preserve it very well. We don't bother anymore. We don't have to memorize. We got books. We got the internet. Don't worry about trying to memorize it. You don't need to. There's all kinds of places that do it for you. But if you don't have the internet and you don't have books, you don't have a written language, if you want to preserve information, you have to memorize it, and you memorize it word for word. So, in fact, I think that's what was happening personally with Elihu. He was listening, as a young man, listening to this dialogue going on. He was memorizing what they were saying so that it could be recorded for future generations. OK, Consider this. People in the Islamic faith memorize the entire Quran. And the Quran has a lot more in it than the book of Job. And it's much more challenging to memorize the Quran than it is the content of the book of Job. So that's how the book of Job was preserved before Hebrew became a written language. I mean, the scholars are right. Hebrew did not become a written language until the 15th century BC. And so if Job is, I say, 20th century BC, then it would have to be preserved through memorization. And it's the only book in the Bible that has this long, extensive poetry that's written in such a way that it could be easily memorized. So that, again, another point that this predates that time. Go ahead.
Yeah, I recall a verse in Job that says, here is my signature. Job's writing his signature. So if he's writing his signature, it doesn't have to be written.
Well, I'll give you an example. My wife and I were in Israel back in 1980. And we were in this restaurant on the Jewish Sabbath. And they came by for me to sign my credit card payment. And they were, for some reason, everybody thought I was Jewish. In fact, when I was at the Wailing Wall, I got reprimanded by a lot of Orthodox Jews for not wearing appropriate apparel. And when I told them I wasn't Jewish, they didn't believe me. So, I don't know, maybe the bald head, the black hair, I don't know. Something with the nose, I don't know. But they're expecting me to sign with an X. Because apparently on the Jewish Sabbath, you're not allowed to write your signature if you're a practicing Jew. And so what you do is you just put an X there and they accept that as payment. And you know, everybody's got the same X, but they accept that as payment. So what I'm suggesting is, yes, they may have had some way where you had some personal scrawl that would be an indication of what you were doing. Other scholars have argued that that particular verse, signature, may have a broader definition than we think of in modern times. But it wouldn't surprise me if it was a real signature. But you could have a signature. And again, you can go to these primitive tribes. Some of these tribes that don't have a written language, nevertheless, you've got people signing things just with some kind of a scrawl. So, but again, I think the strongest evidence that the content of the book of Job predates the content you see in the Torah is the fact that there's no priestly system of sacrifice. The patriarchs are doing it. I mean, it really reads like Abrahamic culture as opposed to Mosaic culture. And that's where the insight of the first few chapters, if you read Genesis 12 through 50, you're kind of getting that Abrahamic insight into the culture of its time. And yeah, that's what scholars have pointed out. If you read the story of Abraham and of Isaac, it reads a lot like what you see in the book of Job. The other thing you notice about the book of Job is that the focus is on semi-desert agricultural activity. And again, that's something that you would have anticipated before you got the rise of empires where there's large-scale cultivation going on. So anyway, I'm not saying it's a settled debate. There are lots of people who disagree with me on this. But I think it helps us understand, okay, we named Job. We named Psalm 104. There's a third one.
Ecclesiastes?
Not Ecclesiastes. But Proverbs. Yes, Proverbs. Which Proverbs?
30.
Not 30. Proverbs 8. Proverbs 8, verses 22 to 31, also takes you through the content of the six creation days. Now, Psalm 104 and Job 37, 38, and 39, and Proverbs 8 don't actually say this happened first, this happened second, this happened third, for good reason. This is poetic literature. And poetic literature really is not well designed for chronology, but if you got it in Genesis 1, it also explains, again, my answer to the atheist skeptic who said, okay, Genesis can't be inspired by God because of all the critical details it leaves out. The most critical details it leaves out are already in the book of Job. It's like Moses saying, I don't have to repeat this. You already know this. And so given that they already had a more detailed account, what you have here in Genesis 1 is a narrative, not poetry. It's chronological, unlike the poetic accounts of creation. And it gives you just the highlights, and it leaves a lot of the highlights out, because after all, the audience that Moses was speaking to already had that in the book of Job. Yeah, you're next.
Yeah, there's a website called inspiringphilosophy.com or something, and he attempts to explain the creation account as being poetic, you know, because he doesn't really, I think, have a lot of insight into science. But anyway, my question is pretty much I'm asking for a yes or no answer, because I know you probably don't want to get off on it, but there is scientific evidence that the Earth was enshrouded with water 100%.
Okay.
You don't have to go into the details, but
I've actually got a set of slides, so I'm going to do that for you.
So I'm going
to get it. So, yeah, you're anticipating where I'm going here. Because, this is the response I got when I put this up on Facebook. They said, what do you mean? There's no way Earth had this kind of a water ocean. It had to be, is this something you just put up there for effect? And I says, no, this is really pretty close to what it was like.
Well, maybe you want to talk about the physical stuff.
Well, okay, I'll be quick on this, okay? This is what the Earth looked like before the moon existed.
Okay.
It had a very thick water and then a thick atmosphere.
Wow.
And yeah, questions I got was, well, what proof do you have? It was a paleontologist who said, what can you cite me some scientific sources that tell me that indeed the water had to be more than 1,000 miles deep? The average depth of the ocean water today is about 4 miles deep, but back before the moon-forming event, it could have been 2,000 or 3,000 miles deep. Okay, here's the scientific evidence in support of that. Number one, we are now finding planets that are reasonably close to what the Earth is like. Earth-like planets, not exactly like Earth, but close. The few Earth-like planets where we have spectroscopy, where we can measure the water content is a minimum of 5% and a maximum of 50%, with the most likely value between 10 and 40%. Okay, to give you a point of comparison, Earth today's total water content from the center of the Earth all the way out, 0.03%, a hair less than 0.03%. So compared to other Earth-like planets, our planet Earth is really, really dry. We only have a thin layer of water, not a heavy layer of water. Now this astounded the paleontologist, but as an astronomer, I explained to him, of all the molecules that exist in the universe, the most abundant is hydrogen too, for good reason. Hydrogen makes up 75% of all the elements in the universe. The second most abundant element is hydrogen 3. The third most abundant element is water, or molecule. Water is the third most abundant molecule in the universe. So the universe is really wet. And people don't think that. They think it's dry. No, it's really wet. I'll give you some more evidence for that. Where it's cold enough, where the liquid water is not going to disappear, or cold enough where it's going to freeze, you see a lot of water. Okay, for example, comets are 85 to 90% frozen water. The moons of Jupiter and Saturn, several of them are more than 25% water. One of the moons of Jupiter is 65% water. Europa is 35% water. So even our own solar system, frozen. Although there's some speculation that with Europa, you've got tidal heating, because it's close enough to Jupiter that as it goes around Jupiter, the tidal friction could be heating up the water below the surface and make it liquid. It's a debate. It may be frozen all the way down. It may be frozen. We know it's frozen for at least the top 26 kilometers. But underneath that, there's speculation that maybe there's tidal heating that makes it slushy or even with liquid water. And so NASA's actually got a plan. JPL out there has got a plan to go to Europa with a probe, drill through that 26 kilometers of ice, and then put down a little robot device with a camera and swim around in the ocean below. And I've actually had a chance to speak to NASA scientists saying, you know, from what I can tell from your literature, minimum cost is $2.5 billion to pull that off, and it could easily be $3, $4, or $5 billion. I says, what's really cheap is to send a spacecraft for a few million dollars to orbit Europa. If you orbit Europa, you'll be able to measure with precision the tidal heating. And that will tell you whether it's ice all the way down, in which case we can save the taxpayers a few billion dollars. Or you might say, hey, there really is liquid water there, in which case it's worthwhile to go there and drill all the way through. Well, not only that, the 26 kilometers is minimum. I mean, wouldn't it be sad if JPL were to send a craft to Europa, they drill down to 26 miles and say, whoops, 26 kilometers, whoops, it's a little thicker than we thought. And oh, we got to send another craft because we're going to drill through 100. And you know, those are issues, but I'm saying, you know, a good way to spend the taxpayers' money, let's orbit. In fact, I think it'd be scientifically really interesting to actually measure with precision the tidal friction that Jupiter's exerting on Europa. And if you get that, you'll also know the tidal friction it's exerting on the other satellites. So, but as I talk to these NASA scientists, I say, we're not so certain that the taxpayer would be all that fascinated about discovering the tidal heating. And saying, well, I'm fascinated, so.
And you're a taxpayer.
I'm a taxpayer, right. Yes. Well, I'm arguing that the Earth before the moon-forming event would have to be at least 5% water. And, you know, that's, 150 times more water than we got now. So if we got a four-mile deep ocean, you can multiply that by 150. And that's conservative. It's probably quite a bit deeper than that.
So the, the water disappeared when the planet collided with the
Earth. Okay, here's the second reason why we know Earth must have been born with a really deep ocean. The moon formed as a result of a large planetary body having a slow collision with the Earth. By slow, it's 4 kilometers per second, maybe a little bit faster. That's still fast enough that if you don't have a deep liquid water ocean, you wind up destroying the Earth and you don't get a moon. The very deep water is essential to allow the moon, because they've done models where they have the Earth with a much thinner layer of water. You either wind up destroying the Earth or you don't get a moon. If you want the Earth to be preserved and you want the Earth to be enriched with heavy elements, which the Earth is, and you want the moon, you want all those three things to happen, all the models tell us you need a really deep ocean to make that work. So for two reasons, we know that's how the Earth started out. As to why it has a thick atmosphere, okay. This is straightforward, almost high school physics, in the sense that the closer you are to the sun, the more the sun's heat is going to drive off the atmosphere. And so you'd expect the atmospheres of planets to be thicker and thicker as you move away from the sun. The other thing is the gravity of the planet. The bigger the surface gravity of the planet, the more stuff it's going to hang on to. So like the moon's got a very thin layer of argon. Why? Because argon's the only element that it can hang on to given its weak gravity. And so there's no carbon dioxide, there's no oxygen. But there is argon. Argon, you know, has a nuclear weight of 40, so that's enough that the moon's gravity can hang on to some. Mercury, which is a little bit bigger than the moon, has a little more argon, but it doesn't have anything else. It's got xenon, argon, just the heavy stuff. Mars doesn't have much of an atmosphere, again, because of its surface gravity. However, using that principle, that the farther you are away from the star, the thicker the atmosphere will be because there's less heat to drive it off, and the bigger the surface gravity, that tells us Earth should have begun with an atmosphere at least 3 times denser or thicker or higher air pressure than what Venus has today. Okay, Venus today's atmosphere is 40 times greater than Earth's. So you work out the math, that's 120 times what we have right now. And now, it says in Genesis 1:2, darkness was on the face of the deep. If you go to Job 38, verses 8 and 9, it tells you explicitly why it was dark. It says, God blanketed the sea with clouds that kept the seas dark. So there the text is explicit in telling us the reason why it was dark was not because there was no sun, moon, and stars. It was dark because the cloud layer was so dense it wouldn't let any light through. Okay, you can sign up for a trip to Venus. Not recommending it, but if you were to go to Venus and land on the surface of Venus, you'd notice it's quite warm. 800 degrees Fahrenheit, so you'd have to have an appropriate suit to keep you cool. But the other thing you would notice if you were on the surface of Venus is that the cloud layer is so thick and dense, the only light that gets through is light at the extreme red end of the spectrum. No blue light, no yellow light, no orange light, no green light. All you get is the very red end. If you were to make the atmosphere of Venus just a little bit thicker than it is, there'd be no visible light coming through at all. Okay, that was the primordial Earth. Its atmosphere being much thicker than that of Venus, there would have been no visible light coming through at all. It would be pitch black all the time. Even with the sun being as bright as it is, it would have been totally pitch black. And that kind of fits what you see in Genesis 1. Because you don't have evenings and mornings, you don't have light and darkness until creation day one. That's because of this atmosphere. It stopped the light from getting through. Okay, now we go to right after the moon forming event. The moon's been formed as a result of this collision into a deep ocean. But what the collision does is that it causes all of Earth's atmosphere and surface liquid water to dissipate into outer space. Totally gone. So now we got a planet with no atmosphere at all and no surface liquid water at all. It's bone dry and no atmosphere.
It's still spherical, right?
So still spherical. Reason why it's spherical? Because of gravity. Notice that all large bodies in the solar system are spherical. If it's only, say, 100 kilometers across, it can have an oblong shape. But the bigger the body, the more it tends to go towards a spherical shape. For the obvious reason, gravity is now so strong, it forces everything to squeeze down into a sphere. So the Earth remains, and the moon is big enough that it's going to be spherical. It has to be spherical because of its gravity. But the event itself causes all of Earth's atmosphere to be thrown into outer space and all the liquid water. Now, fortunately, we live in a planetary system where we have comets and asteroid belts. However, I'll share this with you. Our planetary system has comet and asteroid belts like no other planetary system we can see. The vast majority of planetary systems we observe have no comets and no asteroids at all. No comet or asteroid belts. The reason why is because what's typical of planetary systems is their gas giant planets migrate in towards their host stars. And that migration causes all the comets and asteroids to be dissipated. And so that accounts for about 90% of all the planetary systems we can see where we can actually make those measurements. Yes?
How could we know about these other planetary systems but they do not have these small bodies since we can't see small bodies in other planetary
systems? Well, we can't see the individual bodies, but we can see the aggregate. And so, yeah, we do have the telescope power now to see belts of dust, asteroids, and comets about other planetary systems. Or we can also tell whether they don't have them at all. And this is what it's just been published in the literature in the last couple of years, is that all those planetary systems where we see that the gas giant planets have migrated significantly in towards their stars, we see no signature of dust, asteroids, or comets. The spectroscopy gives you a clue as to whether or not there's a belt of stuff around it. So, and then we see systems that have asteroid and comet belts that are like 1,000 times bigger than ours. And these are ones where the gas giant planets have not migrated at all. If they don't migrate, then you wind up with planetary systems with truly enormous and numerous asteroid and comet belts. At least a factor of 100 times more than what we see in our planetary system, and up to thousands of times. The only planetary system we see that's got a few small asteroid and comet belts is ours. And the reason why is that our gas giant planets migrated in towards the sun, stopped, and reversed. It's what's called the Grand Tack model. And you'll see two chapters on the Grand Tack model in the book Improbable Planet. And it's because of that Grand Tack movement of the gas giants in to just the right distance towards the sun, and then moving back out, that gives us small asteroid and comet belts.
Where do the comets come from? The asteroids come from?
The asteroids and comets come from the formation of the star. And okay, if you get a late-born star, this doesn't happen for early-born stars. So 90% of the stars in the universe are not going to have enough heavy elements to get what they call a circumstellar disk of material. But our sun is recent enough in the history of the universe. It formed about when the universe was 9 billion years old. And because it formed that late, it winds up with enough heavy elements that as the sun is forming, it also has a disk of interplanetary debris about it.
So those comets and asteroids are not, they're still fragments mixed in with that from these collisions?
A lot of it is collisional material because there's so many asteroids and comets that they bump into one another. And that causes someone to break down. How the planets form is that they bump into one another and the stuff sticks. There are things called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. Easy enough for me to say, right? And these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are really sticky. It's like glue. And when the sun is forming, there's a lot of this stuff out there. And so that's what causes these comets and asteroids, what they call them planetesimals, which are basically big asteroids and comets that cause them to stick together. That's how planets form. But there's leftover material from planet formation, which are what are referred to as meteorites, asteroids, and comets. Okay, but the bottom line is this. Because our planetary system has a thin veneer of these asteroids and comets, the next stage is, after the moon-forming event, this veneer deposits upon the Earth a thin layer of water and a thin atmosphere. So this is what happens after the moon-forming event. Yes?
On what basis, you said some people come to the point of view argument that RTV promotes, on what possible basis can they actually object to it? I'm not saying agree or disagree. How can they object to the logic that the point of view is definitely conveyed in Genesis 1, 2, and you contend, therefore, for the rest of the chapter? How can they say, that can't be? What's their basis for saying?
Well, okay, this predominantly comes from the young Earth creationist community and the theistic evolutionary community. They kind of both agree on what they think Genesis 1 is saying. Number one, they think Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, is a summary statement for the entire creation story, rather than a statement of an actual event of God creating the universe, and then, you know, letting things proceed thereafter. And likewise, they think Genesis 1:2 is just part of that. And so we see in the six creation days is a restatement of what God communicated in Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. So they interpret Genesis 1:3 as the Big Bang creation event, whereas I'm interpreting it as that moment late in the history of the universe when the earth was already formed and light now begins to come through the atmosphere, and life can now exist on the surface of the Earth. So there's that point. The other point is, by insisting that the creation days are six consecutive 24-hour periods, they now see Genesis, the six creation day story, as being totally out of sync with science. And so they accuse me of saying, well, you're just putting this point of view in there to try to get a better fit for science, and you're willing to abandon this idea that the days are six consecutive 24-hour periods to make it all fit. Where my own story is, I was reading Genesis seriously for the first time when I was 17, long before I met Christians. It was another 9 years before I really got to know Christians. And reading Genesis 1, it says, hey, it's clear. Genesis 1:1 is talking about the Big Bang. Genesis 1:2, much later, where the earth is now existing, but it's formless and void. And creation day 1, Genesis 1:2, is giving us the frame of reference for what's happening next. Probably because, being educated in Canada, I was taught the scientific method in grade 1. I taught it again in grade 2. We got it every year. The Canadian education system, they hammer you with the scientific method. And so when I first picked up the Bible at age 17, began to go through it, I read it from that perspective. In other words, don't interpret, step 1 of the scientific method. Don't even attempt to interpret until you first identify the frame of reference. Number 2, don't even attempt to interpret until you identify the initial conditions. You know, it struck me the first time I picked up the Bible, right there in Genesis 1:2, what does it do? It gives you the frame of reference and the initial conditions. I said, wow, this is just like the scientific method. 9 years later, I discovered why Genesis 1 so perfectly follows the scientific method. It's basically the origin of the scientific method. Thomas Torrance, with the Scottish Academic Press, he's passed away now, but while he was alive, a Scottish theologian, he headed up a publishing house to publish a 28-volume set, each one about 300 or 400 pages long, on the origin of the scientific method, and the basically making the point, it comes from the Bible and Reformation theology. So I read the books, and you know, that explained to me. That's why Genesis 1 says what it does. It's basically laying out for us this scientific method.
Can't you say Genesis 1:1 is sort of a summary from the Big Bang down to the initial creation of the earth?
Well, the reason why I don't go that direction, and again, there are a lot of people disagree with me on this, is that as I go through the rest of the Bible, I find a lot of other passages also addressing the cosmic creation event. There are 9 places in the Old Testament where you see the phrase the heavens and the earth. And what that taught me was that phrase, heavens and earth with the definite articles, if you look at those 9 passages, it's referring to the origin of physical reality. When God brings into existence matter, energy, space, and time. And it's consistent with what you see in the New Testament. Hebrews 11:3, the universe that we can detect did not come from that which we can detect. Well, what can we humans detect? We can detect matter, we can detect energy, we can detect space and time. So there again, it's consistent with these Old Testament texts. So that's why I was very comfortable interpreting Genesis 1:1. That's the cosmic creation event, when a transcendent God steps in and supernaturally, out of nothing, brings into existence this universe of matter, energy, space, and time. But yeah, there are a lot of theologians who disagree with that.
It wouldn't interfere with the point of view at all.
Well, my whole point is, the point of view for Genesis 1:1 is not the same as the point of view for Genesis 1:2.
Agree.
Genesis 1:1, the point of view is the entire universe. Genesis 1:2, it changes the point of view. Now again, this explains why there's so much confusion in Genesis 1. A lot of people try to imply one point of view on the entire chapter. And so they take the point of view of Genesis 1:1 and apply that to the 6 days. But I would argue, look at what Genesis 1:2 says. It's very explicit in telling us where that point of view is. Let me read that to you again, if I can find my card here. Here we go. Now the earth was formless and empty, darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. So notice it's explicit there telling you where the Spirit of God is operating. He's operating on the surface of the waters. So at age 17, I says, that tells you, that's the point of view from which I am to interpret the account of the six creation days. And when you take that point of view, everything perfectly fits the order of events that astronomers, physicists, and geologists, and paleontologists would apply. Okay, let me go on here. I know there's more questions, but let me finish this because I don't want to use up all the time here. This is right after the comets and asteroids, that very thin, small, we have five small belts of comets and asteroids, but they deliver to the Earth the volatiles, because mainly your comets, for example, are almost entirely, 98%, what we call volatiles, which are frozen gases. And so that brings the water, that brings our atmosphere, but it's still opaque. Yeah, we get a new atmosphere, but it's still no light is able to get through to the surface of the waters. And then on creation day one, it transforms where the atmosphere is no longer opaque, it's now translucent. Say, how does that happen? It's through changing the chemistry of the atmosphere that it goes from opaque to translucent. Now by translucent, I know this is hard for those of you who live in California all your lives because you rarely have translucent skies. But where I grew up in Vancouver, British Columbia, we had translucent skies about 90% of the time. What does that mean? Totally overcast, you can't see anything in the sky except clouds. And so this was the condition on creation days 1, 2, and 3, where the atmosphere would let light through, but there were clouds that covered the whole of the sky. And so you wouldn't be able to see the sun, moon, and stars. Creation day 4 is where it goes from translucent to transparent, at least on occasion, where now you can actually see creatures on the surface of the earth can actually see for the first time the sun, moon, and stars. And notice the text is quite explicit about this as well. Let there be lights in the expanse of the sky, verse 14, to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons, days, and years. You need to know where the sun, moon, and stars are in the sky in order to know what season it is, in order to know what time of day you're in order to know where you should be walking if you're in the forest to go to the direction you want to go. That's one of the challenges of being in a place where there's just clouds all the time. You really have no marker to tell you where true north is. But if you can see the stars, then you've got a direction pointer. And it's well known, for example, that birds use the positions of the stars to migrate. And birds can actually go thousands of miles from one area to back to where they nested the year before. And they can do it to within a few hundred feet. Why? Because they're looking at the position of the stars, flying in the sky, looking at the stars. And again, notice what the text is saying. For the first three creation days, there are no animals and no birds. If you're not an animal or a bird, you really don't care about the sun, moon, and stars are in the sky. It makes no difference to your lifestyle if you can't see the sun, moon, and stars. But if you're a bird or an animal, it does make a difference. It's crucial that you reproduce at the right time of the year. It's crucial that you feed at the right time of the year. So for example, you know, growing up in Canada, what I would notice was the birds and the animals would feast as much as they could during the summer because they knew winter was coming. And by looking at the sun, moon, and stars, they had a pretty good idea when they were no longer going to be able to have the food supply. Their goal was to pack on as much fat in their bodies during the summer months, so when the winter came, they'd be able to make it to the time when the plants would show up again. And so, again, for the first 3 days, no animals and no birds, but once you get to creation day 5, you've got animals and birds. And these are the creatures that need to be able to mark the seasons, days, and years. So that's why you see that there in verse 14 and 15. Let there be the great lights so that they'll mark seasons, days, and years. And again, when I was 17, the question is, who needs that? Then I read on and said, oh, now I know who needs that. It's these birds and animals, these land animals that need to have that visibility. And to some degree, we humans need it as well. Okay. Several other questions I got on my Facebook was, exactly when do we see this universal ocean being transformed into land masses? Now, nothing in the text is explicit about when you first see land popping up above the surface of the water. If you go to creation day 3, it's talking about large continental land masses now forming permanent barriers to the seas. But again, this is not in the Bible, but this is what we see from the detailed scientific record, that the first appearance of land on the earth were these small volcanic islands that would pop up. And now that you've got life in the oceans, because notice that's what you see here, is that there is just marine life. That's a key prediction of the Genesis 1. The first life will be marine life. Well, we have overwhelming evidence from isotopes that indeed, for the first part of Earth's life's history, it was 100% marine life. So you got this marine life swimming around. And what's brand new in Improbable Planet is some research being done by geophysicists that are actually showing that you need life in order to stimulate the plate tectonics to a sufficient degree to get permanent continents. Why? Because there's all these little microscopic life forms swimming in the ocean, many of which are photosynthetic life, and that to me is a huge challenge to any naturalistic origin of life model. We have evidence, isotope evidence, that the first life on planet Earth included photosynthetic life. Why is that a challenge? The simplest photosynthetic life form has 1,500 gene products. And the really efficient ones have 4,000 gene products. So now we got a really complicated life form that you're bringing into existence out of no life at all.
Bacteria.
Yeah. So, and we have an ecology of bacteria, not just one species. But those efficient photosynthetic microbes, 3.8 billion years ago, began to precipitate uranium into the future subduction zones. And by precipitating uranium into those subduction zones, it provided a heat source. And that heat source enabled the plates to begin to slide underneath one another efficiently. The heat source also enabled a chemical reaction to be produced where you get talc. Isn't that fascinating about our planet Earth? Where we got the big subduction zones, you got the production of talc. And, you know, talc is a lubricant. So you got the temperature, plus you got the lubricant, which allows the plates to slide underneath one another rather than walk. And it's the sliding of those plates that produces the continental land masses. So, and I already got a comment this morning saying, why didn't you post this 2 years ago? So. Well, I literally created these slides this morning, so.
Yeah, what was the first landmass? I mean, did they pop up simultaneously, or?
Well, you'll see an Improbable Planet. There's a diagram there showing you the first two significant continental landmasses. Now, they're not as big as continents today. We're looking at continents maybe the size of maximum a million square miles. But probably more like 500,000 square miles. And the first evidence we have is South Africa and Australia. And we can still identify, they call them cratons. A craton is a small continent, small primitive continent. So yeah, there's a place in central Australia where we can see an ancient continental, remains of an ancient continental landmass, and also in South Africa. So, and then. Oh, no, there was life back then. In fact, I think, yeah. You know, what's interesting is that in order to sustain life on planet Earth, You need long-lasting, strong plate tectonics. If you shut down the plate tectonics, it ends life. Why? Because you can't recycle the nutrients that life needs. Next time you feel an earthquake, I want you all to thank God for the earthquake. Because of earthquake activity, we have the nutrient recycling that's crucial to sustain life here on planet Earth. And yeah, for those of you who live up against the foothills, you've got an investment. Those foothills are going to become the future Himalayas. You're living on future mountain vacation property. Might have to wait a couple million years, but anyway, I keep telling my sons, yes, we're rising. 9 millimeters a year is the uplift we're experiencing here up against the San Gabriel Mountains. It's the second fastest rising mountain range in the world. The only one that's rising faster is the Himalayas. So whenever you climb one of the mountains up here, Mount Wilson or Mount Baldy, every year you're climbing it, you're climbing a higher mountain. All right. So if you climbed it 5 years ago, you didn't climb it as high as it is today. So, but yeah, back to this. First, you would get these small continental islands. And the appearance of these small continental islands actually allows a richer ecosystem of microbes to be there. But yeah, to finish what I was saying, you need strong, enduring plate tectonics to sustain life on planet Earth. But you also need long-lasting life in order to sustain the plate tectonics. There's a synergy between life and plate tectonics. If you take life on planet Earth, the plate tectonics will shut down. If you take the plate tectonics off the Earth, then likewise, life shuts down.
Are you referring to life on land?
Life anywhere. Yeah. So life critically depends on plate tectonics, but the plate tectonics critically depends on life. And there's no accident that the origin of life and the origin of plate tectonics is the same date. So, again, I give that as evidence. This is evidence for the Creator's involvement. It can't be a coincidence that they both happen at the same time. And the fact is that they're both necessary for the survival of the other. Yes?
Are you implying that, if I remember correctly now, plant life is created even before sea life. So for plant life to be created, we had to have land first. Land had to be created first, and then sea life. And I guess I'm wondering, is that different from what you've been explaining?
Okay, this has been a major debate, and it's still a major debate in the Christian community. And atheists, in fact, every time I debated Michael Shermer, he says, this is where the Bible's got it dead wrong. It says you got plants on the continents before you got animals in the ocean, and the fossil record has it exactly the opposite. This is a clear contradiction of the biblical text. Okay, even in our first debate, what I explained to them is, number one, what you see on creation day three is let there be vegetation. It uses the noun desha, and it's a very generic term for vegetation. But it's easy for us reading English language to think it's talking advanced plants. It's talking vascular plants. The word desha includes a lot more than vascular plants. Now, what you see afterwards, it gives you three examples. It talks about fibrous plants, talks about fruit, and it talks about seeds. And again, reading it in the English, you get the idea, wow, looks like it's talking about apricot trees. Because talking about, that's usually how it's translated, trees, seeds, and fruit. So you get the picture of advanced plants. But it's important to realize the Hebrew language has a much smaller vocabulary size than English. And so these terms are much more generic in the Hebrew than they are in the English. However, only recently have we had any evidence that plants on the continental landmasses, vegetation on the continental landmasses, predate the animals in the ocean. 4 years ago was the time when they first discovered that indeed plants were on the continents long before the first animals show up.
The first sea, when you say first animals, you mean the first sea animal?
Well, the first animals that show up on the Earth are sea animals.
Yes, okay.
Okay, so the land animals come after the sea animals.
But not the sea plants.
But not the, well, there have been plants in the oceans too. Or let me use the more generic term, vegetation. Because again, in our 21st century context, we think of plants, we're thinking vascular plants. And so I want to use a more generic term, vegetation. So something that's actually engaging in photosynthesis. You kind of see that in Genesis 1, where it uses that word desheh, where it says, take care of the green plants. And again, it's just simply referring to photosynthetic life. So yeah, I mean, the animals in the oceans had to be eating something. So there was obviously vegetation of some sort in the oceans. Now, it is true, we do not have any fossil record evidence of vegetation in the oceans. We do have fossil evidence of the animals, but not fossil evidence of the vegetation. Nor do we ever expect to find fossil evidence of the vegetation, because we're talking about an event 575 million years ago. And if you're going that far back in time, yes, you are going to have the bodies of the animals preserved, but you're not going to have the tissue of the plants preserved. It's in the water. It's going to be completely decayed away. And so people say, well, how come you don't have the fossils? Well, there's no way we're going to have fossils being preserved, given how far back and given that it's marine. Okay, what happened in 2011 is a paper was published where they said, we have the isotope signature that vegetation was just as abundant on the continents for 200 million years before the first appearance of animals on planet Earth for the 200 million years thereafter. And so that was the first time we had scientific evidence that Genesis got it right, that indeed vegetation predates sea animals. What has happened since 2011, they're now actually finding the fossils of a vegetation that goes back at least 600 million years before the Cambrian and Avalon explosions, the first appearance of animals in the ocean. So now when I'm doing a debate with an atheist, I got a really good response. Not just a biblical response, but a scientific response to their objection. And I think this is great. I mean, Genesis was written 3,500 years ago, and we got emerging scientific evidence right in front of our eyes. That's telling us the Bible got the right prediction. So, but, and sometimes when you don't have evidence, it's just because you didn't look hard enough. And incidentally, the fossil evidence we have is quite sparse. The biggest fossil they have found of vegetation that predates the Avalon explosion is 1 millimeter across. They have fossil parts. They don't have complete fossils, again, for obvious reasons. The geology of the Earth, the chemistry of the Earth, would destroy anything that's bigger. In fact, I'm astounded they found something as big as 1 millimeter. Most of the stuff they find is down at a tenth to a hundredth of a millimeter. So yeah, you probably won't be impressed going to a museum looking at the fossils of this ancient vegetation life. They'll have to show it to you underneath a microscope. You had the hand up first. So Tim, let me go to you first. Or was it you?
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's a lot of discussion about evidence of life vegetation going back 500, 600 million years ago. But then we make the claim that there's life going back to just after the late heavy bombardment, right, which is 3.5 billion years ago?
3.825, plus or minus 0.006. So they really got it nailed down accurately now.
Thank you. So that's a huge gap. And I'm just wondering, you know, what is the nature of the evidence for life in that large gap?
Well, the, okay, and recent update, which you'll see in our Origins of Life book, the first fossils we have of life on planet Earth date 3.47, but brand new, you'll see an article on our website, they've now pushed that back to 3.7 billion years ago, actual fossils of Earth's life. But before that, we've got the isotope signature. And there are three isotope ratios. Carbon, nitrogen, and sulfur. And so if we were to take a little biopsy off your body and compare with the carbon, sulfur, and nitrogen that's in a rock, we would notice that your biopsy has a higher ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13. It's got a higher ratio of nitrogen-14 to nitrogen-15, and it's got a higher ratio of sulfur-32 to sulfur-34. Life, for some reason, likes the light stuff. It doesn't like the heavy stuff. It preferentially will select for the environment the light isotopes, not the heavy isotopes. And so by looking for those isotope signatures, we can tell when life first appeared on the Earth. So those isotope signatures take you back to 3.825 billion years. And that's right after the end of the late heavy bombardment, which is where we get our evidence. The origin of life had to be a rapid event. It wasn't something that took place over a billion years. It happened over a few million years or less.
And so is it correct to say the reason we don't have, well, you said the isotopes are fossil evidence, right?
No, what you've got, you go into these rocks, because when you go back 3.8 billion years, all you got are metamorphic rocks. You don't have pure sedimentary rock. The geology of the Earth has converted all the sedimentary material into metamorphic material, which is why you're not going to find the fossils. I mean, it's quite amazing they found something 3.7 billion. Nobody anticipated that, but they just found it.
So the metamorphic evidence kind of disappears after 600 million years.
Well, what you're stuck with are these zircons that have embedded inside of it what they call apatites, which are basically carbonaceous inclusions inside these zircon crystals. And they withstand the metamorphic forces. And so the zircon crystal basically encapsulates the carbonaceous material inside and prevents it from being damaged beyond recognition by the metamorphic processes. And so by analyzing those little apatite grains inside zircons, they're able to find these complex carbonaceous molecules and see whether or not they have the isotope ratio of living organisms or the isotope ratios we would expect from non-organic sources. And that's also the basis for the claim that Earth's life could not have been the product of some natural process from non-organic material to organic material. Why? Because when we do those isotope measurements, we see no non-organic carbonaceous material. It's 100% postbiotic. None of it is prebiotic, which means the origin of life happened on planet Earth without the benefit of prebiotic building blocks, which is one of the reasons we make it reasons to believe why it must be a supernatural event. Any naturalistic explanation has got to have some starting building blocks. The isotope ratios tell us there are no starting building blocks. They're not there. So, a little bit of a segue. I didn't mean to get into an origin of life talk. Okay. I was going to give Ellen here. Remember last week I was kind of getting on that number six case? Because we had six people that were going to be reporting on the study on the fool. Well, I found Ellen came to me and confessed that she was number six. But she had a good excuse. She wasn't here, after all. And the one time she was here, I wasn't here. So she's all prepared to give a report. Can you tell us something in 5 minutes? Then we'll close. Okay. Now, we want you to use the microphone.
My assignment, and when Dr. Ross brought it up, I really felt ashamed of myself, so the next day I started looking up the verses. So I'm just going to read a couple of them. Fools find no pleasure in understanding, but delight in airing their own opinions. Words from the, some of these are from NIV and some are from the ESV. Words from the mouth of the wise are gracious, but fools are consumed by their own lips. So I just wrote a summary from the scriptures that I found, a description of fools. Atheist, has pride, hot-headed, quick-tempered, enjoys evil, hates discipline, likes to air their own opinion, and I love this one, goes to the left. Let's see, I have that verse.
Is that a paraphrase?
Okay, no. This is my little political statement. Proverbs 10:2. The heart of the wise inclines to the right, but the heart of the fool to the left. Well, I thought that was really great. I knew you'd like that.
That sounds like a tweetable verse.
Okay, trusts in self, not God, does not repent of sins, rages against God, and talks a lot. So.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you, Ellen. And for those of you that weren't here last week, let me give you the assignment that we're going to cover this week, but got sideways. Incidentally, this is not a trivial exercise I took you through. My goal is that each one of you would be prepared to answer questions of this nature on the first few verses of the Bible. Why? Because my experience in dealing with people who have never been to church, have never read the Bible, and have no Christian friends, this is where their biblical objections start. It's basically the first few verses of Genesis.
Where Charles Templeton went off.
That's, yep, a lot of atheists, that's where they go off the tracks. So wouldn't it be great if we're all prepared to at least answer some of these questions on these first few verses? And the thing I've learned throughout my years of ministry, if you can't get the skeptic past Genesis 1, you're not ever going to get him to John 3:16. You got to get him past that foundational chapter of creation. And it also astounds me how many Christian leaders out there have an interpretation that basically agrees with what atheists are saying about the text. And I'll talk to you about this next week, but a book just came out, literally just days ago, Adam and the Genome. And it's basically an effort by conservative evangelical scientists and theologians saying, based on what's happened in genetics, we have to reinterpret both the Old Testament and the New Testament. We've got it wrong for 20 centuries.
That's a pinch.
It is a pinch. And, you know, I've just started reading this book, but my first impression is they're willing to look at the, quote, mistakes in Scripture, misinterpretations of Scripture, but what about what's going on in the record of nature? And as an astrophysicist, I'm amazed at all this focus on genetics. I can't think of one of, you know, it's one of the more complicated sciences, one of the sciences that has the largest unknown systematic errors, and based on that, we feel we've got to reinterpret what Paul says, we've got to reinterpret what Genesis says, and the 20 centuries of Christians have got it wrong. But that's the challenge we're facing. In fact, I refer to this as the new higher criticism theology. Came up in the 18th century and 19th century, and it took 150 years of Bible scholarship to get us past that, but it's coming back, and it's coming back in spades. So I'll be talking a little bit about this, but a lot of it has to do with some questions. Left you with three questions last week. Next week, we're going to dive into it. I'll skip all this other stuff. Why does a fool say in his heart there is no God? Okay, that's a verse you see repeated throughout the Bible. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. Why does he say that? How does a fool say in his heart that there is no God? Why and how and what are the consequences? And what does the Bible say about it?
Because he's so prideful and arrogant.
Well, we're going to get to that next week. We're out of time. So we'll get to that next week. But those are the three questions I want you to address. Why, how, and what are the consequences? And what biblical texts actually address those three questions. And let's see if we can gain some facility, how we can reach out to these fools and bring them, what did you say, from the left to the right? So, got to be careful because we live on the left coast, don't we? So,
unless you're looking south.
Unless you're looking south, all right. Okay. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for this time we've had in your word today. And in your book of nature, thank you, Lord, that you've given us two books to research and study. And Father, I pray that we be able to use what we've learned this morning as a way to reach out to people that are still resisting understanding the book that we call the Bible as the inspired, inerrant Word of God. Father, I pray that they would really come to their recognition that, yes, we do have a book that comes from an alien being, one that's outside of our universe, a book that tells us how we can come into a relationship with our Creator. So, Lord, I pray you would give us specific opportunities, each one of us, in the next week, where we can share with people who don't yet know you as Lord and Savior the good news that we have a trustworthy revelation, and that revelation can show us how we can really experience a depth of love and intimacy far beyond what we've experienced so far. In Jesus' name, amen.
Good to see you.